411 Live.
Well, you can learn about issues that affect us every day.
Real people, real talk.
Made to help people in our community in every way. For your girl.
Hello, this is Beverly Taylor, and this is the 411 Live. Real people, real talk. We have hit another milestone. Praise the Lord. We've completed season 8. And you know, we always like to highlight nuggets from the completed season. We're serving up snippets from all 20 episodes. And last time, we took a stroll down memory lane with episodes 1 through 6. Now in this episode and the next, we're continuing our review. Get ready for a mix of topics tackling important issues in our community, introducing you to some incredible people, and dropping knowledge that might just impact your life. Stay tuned. It's going to be a good one. Let's start with episode 7, Lead Poisoning in Milwaukee. A silent danger and a growing problem. Our children are our future, and I'm sure you all agree. They are precious, and it's our job to keep them safe. But there's a silent danger lurking in parts of Milwaukee, impacting their health. Michael Mannon, the director of Home Environmental Health at the City of Milwaukee Health Department, enlightens us about the extent of the problem. He points out that lead paint, used from the 1920s to 1978, is still present in over 250,000 units, maybe even more, causing hazards when it starts to chip or create dust. And it's not just the paint. Lead can be found in the water and the soil, too. But here's the kicker. State laws are putting a limit on what can be done to tackle the issue.
You know, to get your idea around how much does it take, right? All that you need is a packet of sugar that most people are familiar with and spread that throughout your entire house. One packet of sugar. That's as little as it takes to get a child poisoned.
Oh, wow.
And then you think a look at all of the areas that could deteriorate just on regular use. Not necessarily busting a hole into a wall. You've got windows going up and down. Every time you open and close those windows, those friction surfaces deteriorate and they create dust.
Yeah.
Dust blows in right at the height of a sill that kids would want to take a look at, put their hands on, maybe falls onto the floor. People are walking, especially young children that are crawling.
Oh, wow. That gave me a visual. Child crawling. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just doors opening and closing. I mean, we only open our windows maybe on hot, warm days, right? But a door opening and closing every time you walk past it, every time you step on that threshold, all of that could have lead paint on it, deteriorates, and you just drag it right into the home. So there are lots of ways for that dust or deterioration to get into the built environment.
Right. What's prevalent lead? Prevalent in Milwaukee, it's in the paint, in the water, and in the soil, right?
Yeah, and it's important to note where it comes from, right? So we know it's on the coating, the walls, doors, windows, porches, things like that. How does it get into the soil? Well, that's because the exterior of the home is painted in lead, and weathering, just normal weathering, could deteriorate it, and then you get chips into the soil all along where your drip line is, around where your gutters go straight vertically down. So, or from your gutter itself pushing out some of that lead paint, because your gutters might have been painted with it. So that's how it gets into the soil. So it's predominantly in the soil from paint. We did have a lot of gasoline that was leaded. And so a lot of vehicles that were driving in the 30s, 40s, 50s, before they took lead out of gasoline, all that exhaust was leaded, and it would settle into the soil as well. So not, we don't have to worry about that as much, but I guess my point is there's lead in the environment, and our task is to diminish the amount of lead so that the impacts don't affect people within their homes or their community.
Okay. That's a great overview. Thank you. So now with Milwaukee, we have a concentrated area, right, for this lead. Like you said, it's spread out because a lot of homes were built before 1978. But there's a concentrated housing stock, I guess you would say?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question because it really opens the door to discuss all of the issues that kind of intercede in that space. One of them is the fact that you got old housing that has lead paint on it. But we know old housing with lead paint isn't enough to cause lead poisoning. We can go into some areas of Milwaukee like Bayview where they have the same age of construction but less poisonings. Mm-hmm. That's because those properties are maintained better. Now we go to certain parts of our city where we know the properties aren't maintained. And why aren't the properties maintained?
Episodes 8 and 9 were a review of season 7, so let's move on to episode 10, where we pick up on the lead issue. The episode is called Learning Challenges and Barriers Faced by Children with Lead Poisoning. Let me hit you with a stat that really caught my attention. In 2021, the percentage of Milwaukee children with elevated blood lead levels was nearly double the state average. That's not a small matter, considering that lead poisoning can cause behavioral issues and learning disabilities. Joining me in this eye-opening discussion was Holly Manis, a public health nurse with the Milwaukee Health Department, Shaquita McElroy, and Deanna Branch, two incredible parent advocates with the Coalition of Lead Emergency, or COLE. They're not just talking the talk. They're sharing their personal experiences as moms dealing with the impact of lead poisoning of their children. Together, we're digging into the importance of testing, case management, and community collaboration. They offer practical prevention tips as well.
It wasn't until a routine lead check at the WIC office where I was alerted that, you know, he had a high lead level. And the WIC office just told me to take a man to his pediatrician. I really didn't know it would be as severe to the point where when he did get tested, he was admitted into the hospital. What, 2 days after the test results came back, he was being admitted into the hospital. I had so many questions that I felt like weren't really being answered. It wasn't really until just becoming a member of COLE that I learned the severity of really all of my child had to face. But there definitely were signs that were being passed off as just like, oh, you're just going through a terrible two-face. It's what they call it. But it was definitely signs that I felt as a parent, I really knew something was off. So it was just hard to, all of my worries were, it came to a full head when he was diagnosed with lead poisoning. And after he was diagnosed with that, a lot of other things came about with his behavior as far as ADHD and ODD, and it just really is a lifelong process for any child who is lead poisoned. No matter the severity, there's no safe level of lead in the blood for a child.
Yeah. And so when you were at the pediatrician, I think, were you telling me that you told the doctor something seems a little off?
Yeah, this is before the WIC office appointment. And I was just, before I moved into the house that he was lead poisoned in, but he was having, it was a, I don't think it was the lead level in the first house where my eldest son were living in. It wasn't as bad. But the pediatrician office in the neighborhood I took him to, she didn't really address my concerns when I was having concerns about his behavior. She just passed it off as terrible two-faced. Every child is different because I didn't experience those symptoms with my oldest son. It wasn't until I moved into a new house with my sons and a new pediatrician. And after the WIC office visit, that's when she really was more hands-on and addressed my concerns, got him tested right away, and walked me through the process of him being admitted into the hospital for lead poisoning. And I just feel like she really was a big help. She's a part of COLE now. She's an awesome pediatrician that he still visits to this day. And she's going to be my new daughter's pediatrician as well. She's just awesome. It's just really great to, all of this craziness, I created a lifelong friend with my pediatrician. It's been great knowing her.
Yeah, and I should mention that you are an expectant mother, so congratulations to you for that. Tell me the effects that you were mentioning.
It really is different for every child. My oldest son, he wasn't as impacted. He wasn't hospitalized for his lead poisoning. But he does have problems in school that affects his learning process. It's hard for him to concentrate and focus. He has dyslexia. So he has barriers that it makes it hard for him to, you know, get up and just, he writes things. And
Episode 11, Empowering Futures, Northwestern Mutual's HBCU Connection Scholarship. Here, we shine a spotlight on the scholarship program designed to support students pursuing education at accredited, historically Black colleges or universities, HBCUs, and address social and racial disparities faced by young people in Milwaukee. Steve Ratke, president of Northwestern Mutual Foundation, and DeEssence Johnson, a scholarship recipient, now attending Miles College, are my guests. Together, we delve into the significance of unlocking the full potential of talented individuals and the positive ripple effect it can have on the community.
We have tried to identify kind of what we call pipelines, and that's kind of an odd phrase, but we've looked at schools, high schools, again, primarily those that are serving, you know, students of color or people who might be coming from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, where they can get a real quality high school education. Then looking at those high schools, and, you know, we work very closely with, you know, some of the our schools. We work closely with our Howard Fuller Academy, Milwaukee Academy of Science. I know you've had some of the leaders of those schools on your program before. Then look at the schools, the grade schools that they go to, and, you know, make sure that those grade schools are being supported. And then even back to pre-elementary school education to make sure before they're even in school, they can are exposed to opportunities to read and, you know, get those fundamentals before they even enter a formal classroom. And then look beyond high school into college, and what can we do to provide wraparound services, again, for people who are, you know, might be first-generation students. Another program we're heavily involved with is All in Milwaukee, which helps support, we're supporting 100 students who are going through the All in Milwaukee program, who are going to college locally. Again, so we can help these students throughout their entire learning career. And again, we want everyone to have a great opportunity to be leaders in Milwaukee and come work at Northwestern Mutual someday.
Yes, absolutely. And I think about, you know, the work that you're doing, and it seems it's even more important after the pandemic, because so many kids got behind because of the pandemic, and there's a lot of catching up that needs to be done and a lot of focus on education. And the more people that are involved in this, the better, to help these kids to get where they need to go. And just knowing that there is that support, that they are supported and people are pulling for them, I think that really makes a difference. DeEssence, I want to ask you about, and I talked to you earlier, you are the first in your family to go to college, right? And tell me what that means for you.
Yes, I feel like I am breaking a generational curse. I'm making a way for the rest of my family, the ones that are younger than me, to go to college as well. Although my older brother and my mom didn't fully make it through college or get to the college point, they both were excited for me to push me to go out of state and to continue my journey here at Miles College.
Yeah. And I can imagine that you have a younger brother. You're going to college. Him seeing what you're doing and what you will accomplish, I would imagine that you think possibly that that would have an influence on him.
Yes. My little brother, he already wants to go to high school in Texas. I don't know why, but he just wants to travel. He definitely likes to be out and to see what the world is.
Yeah. How has that just getting away? Because, you know, I talk to a lot of kids and a lot of people haven't ventured out past Milwaukee. So how has that whole idea of moving hundreds of miles from home, how has that impacted you?
I get sad at times, but at the same time, technology has taken a lot into society, and FaceTime, group calls, all of that. So we're all on FaceTime 24/7, getting ready for school, work, all of it. So I see them every day.
That's good. I wonder who was more anxious about the move, you or your family?
Me.
You think you were?
Yeah, my family wasn't, they wanted me to go, but they weren't like quite ready for me to go in.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our review of season 8.
Even the mighty might not see it coming. It's prediabetes, and it captures 1 in 3 adults. But you can escape. Take the 1-minute prediabetes risk test to know where you stand and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear. But don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Potential tax breaks?
Ooh.
This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Welcome back. We continue our review of Season 8 of the 411 Live, Episode 12, Family Dynamics, Love, Challenges, and Explosive Relationships. This is a raw and honest conversation with Ira Harris, author of It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. Harris unfolds her personal journey in her book and shares with us the profound impact of a loving grandmother and the challenges posed by a troubled father. Harris drops some wisdom, emphasizing the importance of teaching children about God. She believes that understanding and living by God's ways offer a better chance than navigating the corrupted ways of the world.
He was older, much older than my mom. I think my mom was 16 or 17.
Oh, she's very young.
Yeah, and he was in his late 20s. And from what my grandmother said, they used to go fishing all the time. Uh-huh. My grandmother, her husband, and my mom and the kids. So they used to go fishing all the time. And they met in church, and he wanted to take my mom fishing. And my mom ended up getting pregnant behind going fishing.
Okay.
So
that, you want a different kind of fishing.
Mm-hmm. But I do know that they both was in church.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that's where all this sentimental and spiritualness inside of me comes from.
Okay.
Because it's in her background.
So she got pregnant. That's with your sister.
The oldest girl, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And my grandmother said they had moved to Kenosha. I don't know if I was born. I can't remember. They had moved to Kenosha after she had the my oldest sister.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is my dad was abusing my mom. But somehow the neighbor knew my grandmother and called my grandmother and told her what was going on with my mom, that my dad was locked her in the house, wouldn't let her do nothing. He can hear her screaming and stuff like that. So my grandmother said she sent my mom's youngest sister over to Kenosha to rescue my mom.
Okay.
And brought her back.
Okay.
So
and the baby and Liberty.
I think
your sister was Liberty.
Her, that's her nickname.
Okay.
So I believe I was born then.
Okay.
And then to continue that, she ended up my mother. I remember this so clearly. My mom went to court for child support, or either she got subpoenaed and had to go to court for whatever.
Uh-huh.
So it was me and my older sister. And I know for a fact I wasn't no more than about this tall. Mm-hmm. So I had to be about maybe 7 or 8 years old. And the courtroom was dark. The judge was an elderly white man. And we sat there for a while. And then he finally called my mom's name. I don't remember all the words, but what stuck in my mind was my dad crying to the judge saying.
Episode 13, From Stroke to Redress, Reggie Jackson's Journey of Healing and Advocacy. In the healing process, sometimes you have to go back to your past and address it. That's precisely what we do in this episode as we discuss the Redress Movement, a national organization committed to empowering communities to address racial segregation. We also focus on the healing process of our guest, Reggie Jackson, a historian and co-owner of Nurturing Diversity Partners, who is also in the healing process from a stroke. He shares his journey of recovery and how he became involved in the redress movement. Learn about the historical forces that intentionally created segregation, the impact it still has on our communities today, and the steps being taken to redress the damage caused by these policies and practices.
It came as quite a surprise. Fortunately, my wife was with me when it happened, and she forced me to go to the emergency room. You know, I just told her, I said, I just feel kind of tired. I'm just going to go home and, you know, get some rest. And she's like, we're going to get you behind to the hospital. So, you know, I listened.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, went to the hospital, and they told me right away, yeah, you had a stroke. And they kept me there for 3 days doing some, you know, some testing and, you know, no real treatment right away, but just looking at, you know, the condition of my brain and, you know, how it impacted my body. Fortunately, it wasn't a really major stroke. It was a pretty minor stroke. I mean, no stroke is really, really minor.
Yeah.
But the damage that it caused wasn't anything significant. You know, there was no paralysis. It just impacted the strength on the left side of my body and made my voice, you know, not the voice that I'm accustomed to hearing. So that's the biggest struggle I've had is just, you know, getting my voice strong again. But my body feels great. I've lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, you have.
Some lifestyle changes. Yeah. You know, eating a lot better, Beverly. Mm. My wife and I are both so much healthier now. And my body feels the best it's felt in years.
Yeah. Now health is taking a priority, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and I said last November, and you know, just talking to you now, is because we were waiting for that voice to get stronger. Right. So progressively, it has gotten stronger.
It has. It's still, you know, a ways to go. Yeah. But, you know, it's stuff that I work on every day to strengthen it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It'll take a little while before it gets back to where I want it to be. But, you know, it's significantly stronger now than it was even a few weeks ago.
So, you know, at the intro, I was talking about delving into the past, looking at the past so you can move towards a brighter future. And the reason why I brought that up is because of the redress movement that you're involved in. And it is, it's kind of a way of, I look at it as healing, really. Tell me a little bit about redress movement and how you're involved in it.
So I joined the redress movement officially last year. I was hired as a member of the research team. It's a national organization that launched in 3 cities initially: Charlotte, North Carolina, Denver, Colorado, and Milwaukee. And the Redress Movement is a Black-led organization committed to leading a multiracial movement that empowers communities to take direct action to redress racial segregation. And, you know, we've all heard Milwaukee's the most segregated place in the country. So, you know, we're the poster child for segregation in many respects. And so the Redress Movement works in deep partnership with local communities to repair the harm caused by intentional policies to segregate communities. And we do our work by educating, and not only educating, but also mobilizing communities and shift the narrative about how we became segregated and the impact of that. And then winning redress victories. So holding people accountable for creating the segregation that we have and the negative impacts of that. Okay. Is really an important part of what Redress is trying to do. And our starting point is housing, but we work in solidarity with others who are working on, you know, social justice issues and redressing harms of the past. It's really important, as you said, you know, the past really is something that we have to address. We can't just continue to ignore the ugly parts of American history because it's still impacting us on a daily basis, even if we don't see it.
Episode 14, Reclaim, Renovate, Reinvest, Changing Neighborhoods One Block at a Time. The best way to address community issues is through bottom-up solutions. This means tapping into the insights of individuals who have personally experienced poverty and possess a profound understanding of the challenges faced by the community. I have this candid conversation with Kurt Owens, the pastor of You Flourish Church of Milwaukee and the founder of Bridge Builders, a neighborhood development organization. Kurt shares his personal journey from being a drug dealer to becoming a pastor, his choice to stay in his neighborhood and create a positive impact, and the mission driving Bridge Builders Their aim? To inspire inner-city innovation and transform neighborhoods one block at a time.
There are some folks from your background who might be surprised at what you're doing now, right?
Yeah.
Because, and you alluded to it earlier, but your life took a different path. I mean, you're a pastor now. I think you're a PK, too, pastor's kid. But somehow things got off track, I guess I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you a drug dealer?
I most certainly was. I most certainly was. You know, I think I was attracted to it very young, or at least I was attracted to just the lifestyle of seeing people in my community. Most of the people in my community were blue collar. I'd never seen a black lawyer. I'd never seen a black doctor. I'd never seen a black white collar anything. Neighborhood I grew up in, it was just all blue collar. I wasn't attracted to blue collar. Mm-hmm. My dad was blue collar. I just wasn't. And I believed that I couldn't be anything that I wanted to be in life. And so I just figured that I'm going to have to make my own way. And it's crazy because the same year that I started college was the same year I became a drug dealer.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And I was going to school during the days, you know, living the life of a drug dealer at night. And I became really good as being a drug dealer. And so I dropped out of college. And I thought life was grand at the moment. And all of a sudden, you know, I was shot at a number of times. I was robbed by gunpoint.
Wow.
And probably the last time, I watched friends get murdered. Go to prison for a long time, and for whatever reason, like God's hand was on my life. The last time I was robbed, you know, I was told to get down on my knees, and I just like, I'm about to get executed.
Wow.
And I just remember just saying, like, I only got enough time to say, Lord, forgive me. And I did. When I seen that I was still alive, I'm like, God, if you get me out of this situation, I promise I'll change my life. And I was able to escape, long story short, and I knew that, like, God had spared my life, didn't understand why, because I did nothing to make him happy.
So what happened in Sussex that really kind of changed your thinking?
Yeah, well, people wanted to kill me in Milwaukee, so it was a great it was a great outlet to spend all of my time in Sussex. And I was preparing myself for, you know, my dad was born in 1936 in Mississippi, so my idea of white America was formed by, you know, my dad. And so I was embracing myself for racism and all of those things in Sussex. And actually, I experienced just the opposite. I was kind of confused.
Yeah.
And it was at that moment that I realized I couldn't put everybody in the same basket. You know, sometimes we just use broad strokes. But I took a job there making $7.50 an hour. It was pretty humbling. But my boss, you know, he just began to show me love, and I don't know why again at that moment. And he was white,
uh-huh.
Which was surprising to me again. And he promoted me over and over and over again, made me warehouse manager, brought me into the front office. He told me he had trained me on anything I wanted to learn in the front office if I'd be willing to punch out. I did, and when a position opened up in the front office, he would put me in it, and I just kept working.
Well, it's evident that the 411 Live is all about delving into a range of intriguing topics. And let me tell you, we've only just scratched the surface in these episodes. I highly recommend you checking out the full podcast or catching them on YouTube. And of course, don't forget to smash that subscribe button. Just so you know, the 411 Live is a nonprofit organization. If you'd like to support us, head over to our website, the411live.org. I'm Beverly Taylor. Thanks for joining us for the 411 Live. Real people, real talk. God bless. If you would like to check out past episodes, there are many ways. Go to your favorite podcast platform. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Like and watch us on Facebook. Watch and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you have suggestions for future episodes, go to our website, the411live.org.